You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Why did Stephen Hawking write his best-selling book, A Brief History of Time? I was surprised to hear the answer, and it was basically from the source's mouth, or one source away. I'm having one of my usual discussions with Dr. Brian Keating. We talk about a variety of fun, interesting topics, including why Stephen Hawking wrote A Brief History of Time.
What's been so interesting, James, let's see, Jay, you're still recording, right? Okay, so you ever hear the book Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking?
Yes.
It was actually one of the first, if ever, like really, truly successful popular science books. And this guy, Leonard Mlod, now speaks about writing books with Stephen Hawking. And it turns out, like, I didn't realize two things about that book. First of all, I bought it when it came out in, like, 1988. I was in high school. I was, you know, thinking about being an astronomer. And I couldn't comprehend almost anything in it. And I remember going, when I was getting my PhD in the mid-90s, I went to the Royal Astronomical Society in London to hear Stephen Hawking speak. And at that time, he could still speak using, I mean, he could still move his finger. Somebody in the audience asked him, they said, Professor Hawking, why did you write this book that is rumored to have never been read by anyone, maybe even by yourself, that's so successful? And he said, because my kid needed to pay for college, you know, and, you know, in that synthesized voice that was so iconic. And I remember laughing, thinking that was kind of funny, or maybe even like, not venal, but whatever. It was just like, did he really write a book just to make money? Like, first of all, how do I get to do that? You know, and hence I wrote Losing the Nobel Prize, which, you know, 37 people read. Well, but anyway.
there's a joke that someone makes that someone says to Stephen Hawking, you know, oh, everybody loved your book so much. And he was like, really? Because I only did about four pages of science and the rest of it was just Harry Potter fan fiction.
and nobody noticed it.
So nobody got to that part.
Yeah, actually, they came out not too far apart from one another. But then I realized from talking to this guy that he actually had like severe anxiety that he was the sole breadwinner for like this huge clan of people. And it reminded me of like Galileo. Galileo was never married. He like had a lot of children. And Stephen Hawking actually, like, one of his nurses who became his wife, she was married to the computer programmer that programmed his wheelchair and his voice synthesizer. Like, he used the speech synthesizer that this guy did him this favor to make for his wheelchair, and then he seduced the man's wife. So
he was a player.
I was astounded by that. But anyway, but I realized that he had to make money to support, you know, ex-wives. He's married, divorced twice, I believe. And they had kids, and he there were like a lot of legal things. Like one of his kids was suing like one of his nurses because he thought she was like beating him up. He had to be turned like every hour. Imagine you're sleeping and like you have to be turned over and your bedpan checked and your tracheotomy, you know, has to be cleaned out. Like all these, he had tremendous needs. And so he became, I asked this guy Milad now, he became a corporation. Effectively. So I asked him, what was he like? What spoke to me most about this book that they wrote, that he wrote about Stephen Hawking, called A Memoir of Friendship, was that he was a businessman and he was very astute. So much so that he basically like breach of contracted a couple of his publishers at various times in his life, you know, starting with that first book where they wanted to give him an advance of $25,000. Can you believe it? Can you imagine getting an advance that big, James?
No way. That's rich.
I know. So he said no, and he ended up getting like this profile of him in the New York Times, and then Bantam Books, which never was really a publishing imprint. He basically created them, and so much so that when he went back for his final couple of books, he demanded like they double his advance, like from, you know, $500,000 to like triple it, whatever. And they did it. They were just like, you built this place. But he was so aggressive that, you know, he had to take care of people. And I never really fully appreciated that. And the other thing I never appreciated about that book was it was really a polemic against God. Like, you don't think about that, you know, particular book. You think of it as, oh, it must have been very mathematical. Nobody read it. But it's really about like kind of eliminating one of the two ways that Stephen perceived the role of God being in the universe. And I found it fascinating because now I'm reading it and it's like, I don't want to sound egotistical. I can understand it much better than I could when I was 16. Okay.
I've tried it a couple of times. I have not been able to read it.
So you and I should go through it. It's actually a great book. It's well-written. It's well-argued. But what he's doing is he's arguing for one of the ways that we're going to talk about next time of how the universe could have began that he worked on with his colleague from UC Santa Barbara, a man by the name of James Hartle, who's still alive. And they worked on a proposal in which the universe could have originated from nothing. It was really the first exposition of how a universe could come from nothing, not without the multiverse yet included.
Well, don't some particles appear out of nothing?
Yeah, but by definition, almost we can't detect them. So yes, in order to have a self-consistent treatment of quantum mechanics and electrodynamics, you have to posit the existence of what are called virtual photons. You can take two. So do you consider photons to be something? Like in a vacuum, there's photon. Like if you go out into interstellar space, a billion miles away from Proxima Centauri's Uranus, you go out there and you make a little box, and the box is the size of your thumb. How much stuff is in there? Like if you do a survey of what the heck is in that box, a Keating's thumb worth, what's in there? What do you think is in there?
I don't know.
So it's mostly completely empty. You're likely to have absolutely nothing except for 420. That's the only way I can remember it is it's 420 time. And 420 photons from the CMB. That's basically all that's in there on to good approximation. If you've got a cubic meter, you'll have a proton, you'll have some dark matter sprinkled in, and that's about it, plus, you know, trillions of photons now. But in every cubic centimeter of the universe, there are 420 photons. Now, every so often—
Exactly 420?
Well, 400, you know, statistically, you know, there's plus or minus something. It's actually 419. Uh-huh. Anyway, I don't want to get into that. I'm not allowed as being on parole conditions. But anyway, do you remember what a black body is? So this is actually why Planck, you know, started thinking about the quantum revolution. If you look at the sun is a black body. Anything that you heat up that has ordinary matter will glow at a different temperature and a different color depending on how hot you heat it up only. So when you put an iron into the fire, it glows reddish. That's because it's cooler than the surface of the sun, which glows yellow. If you could keep heating it up, it would turn blue and violet, and then it would go ultraviolet. You never see it. So there's some amount of energy in what's called a black body. It looks kind of like a bell curve, and it's a distribution of colors and wavelengths for an object at a given temperature. And the CMB is a classic. It's the most perfect black body there is. There's some finite probability that the cold CMB radiation, that every so often there might be a photon which has just exactly twice the mass of an electron, and then it will collide with another one moving in the opposite direction with exactly twice or the mass of a positron or an electron. They'll come together, they're electrically neutral, they'll create from nothing a positron, and which is the antiparticle to an electron. So they'll make an electron and a positron.
And so isn't this part of the theory that you're talking about, where enough random photon-like particles created enough real matter that is how the universe was born?
So in their conception, what they're more interested in is creating time, not creating matter yet, although that will have to, emerge at some point. But their proposal was that time could come into existence. The same way you're just proposed that matter comes into existence from non-matter, they were proposing that time itself could come into existence. In other words, it would come out of some other property that was pre-existing. Namely, it could come out of the separation of a spatial dimension which no longer exists, if that makes sense.
It doesn't. I'd have to understand. I'd have to research that more.
So we should talk about that. But the reason I wanted to bring it up now is that it stands in contradistinction to, any of the theistic ways that we've talked about the universe originating. And that was Hawking's intent writing that book. In other words, he took a speculative, he realized that there's only two roles for God in the universe, according to physics. He could say there's a personal God. He didn't believe in that, obviously. But he said, from a perspective of physics, what would a God do? Well, one thing a God would do is create the whole universe, right? That would be what he does, or it does. And the other thing it would do is it would have to establish the laws of physics. So it would have to establish the ways that physical laws and properties of the speed of light, the mass of the electron, et cetera, how those behave. And so he realized if he could undermine either one of those two conditions, he would eliminate the physical requirement that God exists. That was his motivation in writing that book. How did he do it? Well, he argued that this completely speculative theory that he had come up with a few years before with this Professor Hartle at Santa Barbara, that the universe started because time came into existence from a pre-existing spatial dimension, peeling off imagine you got like a bundle of spaghetti. You've got like 1,000 pieces of spaghetti. They're all dry. They're all standing up like sticks. And then you pull one out. So that's kind of like a cylinder that goes just up and down. But then you pull a couple out and they fold out and then now they're perpendicular. You kind of made a one-dimensional thing into a two-dimensional thing. Or maybe you made two pieces of spaghetti that were pointing in the same direction. Now you peel them off, one off from the other one. And now you've got two dimensions of space. We'll talk about it more next time. But that was sort of the idea. You could create a dimension. And since space and time have the same stature within physics, thanks to Einstein, what's called a unity, a continuum of space-time, that therefore you could create the time dimension and it would have an origin, a central coordinate, like 0, 0 on a Cartesian coordinate system.
Well, I have a question. What if it's not? We always act like time is a dimension. What if it's not? What if it's a force like gravity? what if we're being hit by timons, the particle chronicons or whatever. And
that's awesome. That's a great name.
And that's what's moving us forward, because we're constantly being hit by these time particles.
Yeah. So we don't think that time is necessarily quantized, although we think that energy is quantized, and that's the foundation of what the photon actually came to be in the case of light. First, you have to ask, well, what is time? I don't know if you ever thought about it, but it's very, very difficult to define what time is.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Well, how do you think of time?
I don't really...
There's many different kinds, right? There's like biological time, there's psychological time.
Yeah, just basically this idea that events move forward. So there's a past, there's a future, there's right now. Although we don't ever really know, right? We all could just be created right for this instant.
Right.
And it's one of those things that we could argue about, but it has no point.
Yeah, it's like the free will argument that we started off talking about.
Yeah.
Well, one good cogent definition of time, and that's valid what you said. It's not as encompassing. There's no good definition of it. It's basically time is what clocks measure. And then you could say, well, what the hell is a clock? Clock is something that changes. In other words, something that changes, it could be your body. You know that every 30 years, your heart beats about a billion times. So in a lifetime, 90 years, you get 3 billion heartbeats. You know that you can have about, you know, a few thoughts per second at a good, you know. I aspire to have one thought per day, but you can have a couple thoughts per second. So now, like, so imagine now maybe you can have 10. Like, we have a 10 hertz processor in our brain, the equivalent of that in terms of thought generation. So that means, like, a good life, you could make 30 billion thoughts, and you could count them. And, oh, I had a thought. And that would be a clock. You could count your heartbeat. You know, it's not perfect. It does change over time. You could count like rings on a tree. So all these are clocks, and they're just different manifestations of the time measurement problem that we wrestle with. So, you know, I do feel like this is a, you know, kind of a very important challenge, that the definition of time is so squirrely and hard to come up with.
Yeah. So maybe if that's something we're studying. And because we just simply say, oh, it's the fourth dimension. It's like a science fiction novel. But it's a good question. What is it? And maybe it's something that could be measured more accurately the way physics is.
Yeah. Well, we do, you know, think about, you know, the physical ways to measure time. And that brings up clocks, right? So,
think about it though with time. Like when if we're looking at a star, for instance, we're looking at it. We're not just looking at it in space. We're looking how it was 4 years ago,
yeah.
Like Proxima Centauri, because it takes like 4 years to get here. So it's like you could see the past.
Yeah. So I hate that when people say, oh, the space-time continuum. It just sounds like people trying to sound smart, right? Which, you know, I do enough of that as it is. But really, you should think about like what it, not what is time, but what is space-time? Like, in other words, what space-time is sort of... I think of it as a bunch, like a giant monkey bar system, and there are these nodes, and between the nodes there's some space, there's some distance, and the way that you measure distance is by the speed of light. How fast the speed, because the speed of light is the only constant in a universe of relativity. The only thing that's constant is that you and I, no matter how fast we're moving in our careers or otherwise, we will always measure the speed of light to be the same according to us, no matter, and I will always measure it in your frame when you shoot a laser beam and you're moving past me at half the speed of light, I'll still measure the light traveling at the speed of light. That's special relativity. So now, between each of these nodes in the monkey bar, the ball and socket joints that hold the frames of a jungle gym together, there will be some amount of time that it will take a light beam traveling between that location in space to get here. So you could also think about the complementarity. You could say that thing is so many light seconds away or light years away, as you just said. You could measure things in terms of light travel time, and then you're just surveying these different things. Now, what are the things? They're not just objects. They're events. So this microphone is an event because it exists in space, but it also exists in time. So you can think of it like the state of this microphone is an event. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Or your glasses, your hair. It's an event. It's not, you know, some events.
My hair is definitely an event. It's an event every morning when I try to untangle it.
The contanglement of
there's
space.
Tears,
the altar.
There's yelling.
A lot of spritzing. There's a spritzing of a schmutz. So exactly. So we can think about that interconnected web of events. What links them is this melange of space and time put together. And, Yeah. So I think we think of the Big Bang as like space coming into existence. But according to Hawking and Hartle, time came into existence. It was carved out of something that was eternal, that didn't change, and is not a clock. So even a proton or an electron is a clock. It's vibrating. It has some fundamental changeability associated with it. But the universe and space-time itself, these events, you know, which don't have real meaning if time didn't exist, at least the coordinates in space exist in this, in their notion. But the reason I bring it up is that he basically assumed that he was right. So imagine I have this theory of the multiverse. And I write this book. I say, if there is a multiverse, we don't need God. Oh, look, I did this work with this guy who won the Nobel Prize. I proved that, you know, and then I wrote this book, and everyone accepts the conclusion of the book. Therefore, they'll accept my conclusions that there's no God, right? And there's no evidence for this, you know, a no boundary origin of the universe that we'll talk about next time. There's no evidence for it. In fact, even pursuing evidence for it, it's just something that is a mathematical approach and maybe the consequence of certain aspects of, you know, quantum mechanics or geometry, but there's no evidence for it. So I want to come back to that. Maybe next time we'll talk about that origin of the universe. But then the other, remember I said there were two conditions that God fulfilled according to a physicist like Stephen Hawking to have, yes, a purpose for God. So one is to create the universe. The other one was to establish the laws of physics. Well, guess what? In his final book, The Grand Design, he claimed that the laws of string theory establish the multiverse to be true, and therefore there's an infinite number of possible laws of physics, and we happen to find ourselves in a universe in which the laws of physics are suitable and commensurate with our existence. So behold, he's got them both. He killed God. He got, but there's no evidence, right, for string theory either.
So he basically says that in every universe, there's a random set of laws, and only, you know, out of gazillions of infinite number of universes, maybe one has the laws of physics such that life could exist, or maybe two or three, or, you know,
it could be infinite, but probably infinite,
but like a percentage of the other infinity.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's different levels of infinity, as you know, like there's an infinite, yeah, number of integers, there's an infinite number of real numbers, there's an infinite number of decimal places in an irrational. Yeah, so exactly. But I find it very, I don't know. It's not satisfying to me. The more I get more sophisticated in my appreciation, and it's interesting because, you know, every now and then, like Eric or somebody will, Einstein will ask, but why are you doing podcast? Like, are you trying to be like, you know, Alexander the Great and like survey the whole kingdom of the world until there's no lands left to conquer? And then they say, you know, Alexander wept. No, I mean, I'm actually, now I'm reading things like Sir Roger Penrose and understanding artificial intelligence, which he wrote about in 1989.
Yeah, I mean, podcasting is a great way to just absorb an enormous amount of content, because you have to, you read the books and writings of every single guest, and you have to research and think of things unique to say, else why do a podcast?
Yeah.
And so you learn. I mean, I've been doing, this is like 7 years almost to the day that I've been doing podcasts. Wow. And I've learned, like, if I had never done a podcast, there would be so much less knowledge I would have. And you only remember like 1 or 2% of each person,
if
but
you're lucky, yeah.
Still,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, forcing and having these themes like Nobel Prizes, aliens, Big Bang. And then I'm doing, so like, I had Amy Morin on last week because I'd seen her on your show. So
she's great.
Ended up raising a lot of money for her favorite charity. So that was really fun. Yeah, so I'm thinking about, yeah, what is unique about my podcast, you know, is really have, first of all, I'm doing a lot of live streams where I'm having question and answer for, you know, like my dream is to have Jim Simons do a Q&A, you know, like he never would do that with anyone else. I've had on these really eminent people like Deepak Chopra's, you know, like I said, is coming on. He's got 35 million followers, you know, and I'm not going to pull punches with him. I'm going to say, look, this is how you're perceived by the physics community as a crank, as a kooky, you know, kind of person who picks and chooses laws of physics to suit your metaphysical needs. Why do you feel the license? You know, whatever. But I do it in a way that's, you know, Comitus is friendly, is because I really want to know. I think he's a
well. I would ask, by the way, if
yeah,
I tell would
me,
ask
you, yeah, what do you want me to ask him?
Basically, I mean, his first big successful book was, I think, it was The Seven Laws of Spiritual Success. It had a title like that, uh-huh. And he's very good at translating this hodgepodge of Eastern thought into Western concepts, into then practical, usable context. Like, so he'll take, you know, esoteric aspects of Hinduism, show the relationship between that and Christianity or Judeo-Christian thought, and then take that and basically say, from this, you can derive these seven ways to be successful. Mm-hmm. And so each one of his books are mm-hmm. like that. He's like an interpreter into the different worlds, from Eastern world to Western world to practical world.
What I like about him is that he was for some reason invited. He did like a debate with Sam Harris. And during the debate, you know, he was talking about, you know, quantum physics can like explain this or explain that. And Sam was like, I don't think that's how it works, but I'm not a quantum physicist. And then this guy, it was held at Caltech at the famous auditorium there. And this guy in the audience raised his hands like, I'm a physicist. And it was this guy, Leonard Mlodinow, now who wrote the book, The Drunkard's Walk. And he's like, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. And then Deepak's like, well, why don't you explain it to me? And then the two of them went on to write a couple of books together. And so, oh, wow. So, you know, he is a very curious person. He certainly has an empire. You know, I can go up to there. It's in San Diego County. And you go there and you get Deepak tea. But, you know, how is that different than like Ray Kurzweil, who like believes in the singularity? So take these vitamins, you know, from the Kurzweil vitamin shoppy, and you'll be able to live to see the singularity. You know, so I feel like, look, everyone's doing stuff. There's one thing I've learned from you, and I want to express my gratitude to you for getting to know you so well and having so much fun on the show with you this year, and you coming on my show and hopefully many future returns, is that, you know, the main point is that you're having fun. Like if someone said, Brian, you're forbidden from doing podcasting, you know, the last executive order of Donald Trump is James Maynard is forbidden forever from podcasting on any continent on Earth, including Antarctica. I think it would be pretty devastating to you, not just because your income or whatever, but because it's part of your identification of yourself. And for good reason, you've crafted this like amazing thing. You've done like Stephen Colbert. If they said you can't be a talk show, you'd be devastated.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And you know, when we could have this conversation is, so my book, Skip the Lines, coming out February 23rd. When we talk about that on your podcast, it's related because, you know, people switch interests, switch passions. And then how do you avoid being a dilettante? How do you still get good enough that you could appreciate the nuances, the complexity of what you're doing?
Yeah, exactly. I'd love to talk about that. Yeah, I mean, I was planning, assuming that you were willing to come back on, you know, when the book comes out, and to have you on and talk about our experiments. We still haven't talked about, so I took one of our podcasts that was released recently was about the simulation hypothesis. So how the simulation of the advancement of Moore's law and technology will lead to super powerful virtual reality and so forth. And that will actually be able to simulate entire civilizations and people. And why not with a trillion year advance? Why can't it be that we are the byproducts of a civilization that lives, you know, somewhere in the future or whatever, and simulate, or maybe they are simulations too. Anyway, I took that and I uploaded it to this AI program called Otter.ai. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
No. Is it like GPT-3?
It's not like GPT-3, but that's another thing I want to talk to you about. So GPT-3, what my friend and I were talking about is he took like every one of his guests that he's ever had and he just dumped in the transcripts from them. And then he said, like, who else should I invite on my show? And it came out like, I'll just make it up, Steven Pinker and James Clear. And it was like all these people that he had on his show. And so then he told it, well, I've had those people on my show. And then who else should I have on, basically? And it came out with like these awesome predictions that are like not too hard to get, like James Altucher or whatever, Max Tegmark, just like really accurate. And he's like, wonder if I could get this to not only identify guests for me on the show, but send them a letter, send them an email. Cause you know, like the email, like when I do a cold email to like Barack Obama, I have to say like, I'm this chancellor's professor at UC San Diego. I wrote this book, Losing the Nobel Prize. I host a podcast, YouTube, Dr. Brian Keating, Into the Impossible, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I could just write it and have GPT-3 write it for me and send it to people. And it'll be like tailored for their interest. Like I heard, and it'll take all their previous podcasts. So Barack Obama, you were on NPR and you talked about, and it'll take like some unique thing. Like he studies, let's say he studies artificial intelligence. and it'll just like, oh, you gave this quote once about this book that was written about Ray Kurzweil, and blah, and then it'll be like optimal probability to get the guest to say yes. And he's like, maybe we can take this. Let's have it write the question.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So that's what I want to do with you next year.
You know what would be interesting is load in all, for instance, of Stephen Hawking's books and then have the AI Stephen Hawking as a guest.
That's exactly what I'm thinking of doing when I talk to this guy, Michael Saylor. He's very interested in artificial intelligence and Bitcoin. But yeah, exactly. Take all of Galileo. Take this. When I'm done with the audiobook, I'll dump it into GPT-3 and I'll have put myself out of a job. But won't you get a better education? Won't it be a better service to do that and to be taught, you know, geometry by Euclid rather than Brian Keating?
Yeah, that's I've been wanting. We haven't figured out how to get access to GPT-3, but I want to load in all 700 or 800 of my podcasts that I've done, and then do a podcast with the generic guest of my show.
They want to do it for like academic research primarily.
Yeah,
but I think it'll be a fun experiment. But even before we get there, the first step is for us to use just like already available stuff. So I got this otter.ai. I uploaded our simulation conversation and it like identifies your voice. It gets a lot of things right. And you can pay a little bit more. Like if you normally say, you know, simulation hypothesis, like it won't get that. But then you tell it, this is one of my custom words and it will always get that. Or ekpyrotic universe, it will get that. So you can do stuff like that. So I'll send you it. But what's cool is it's like that Descript program or whatever. You'll hear us talking, you and I are talking, and then it will show you in real time the words that we're saying. And then we can go back and edit the words in the transcript. So the reason I want to do this with you is I want to make a blog post or an article. Just two people sat down and talked about simulation hypothesis and AI transcribed it. Here's what came out. Like it's like an experiment.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. And then, so you need to sign up for this otter.ai and then I can share the file with you and you'll see it going across the screen. But there's so much stuff we can do with this, James. We can do, every single podcast you ever did, we'll turn it into a book basically, like whatever. And we would talk about that some other time. But the other thing it can do, it's not 100% obviously, but what I want to do is start feeding it in like physics stuff, like equations of motion and string theory and like, because maybe some of it won't match up with the data, but it might be like, oh, well, you didn't know that there actually is this observed signal from like 65, you know, papers ago, and you just never knew it because a human being can only absorb 1% of what he or she reads.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm gonna look that up, otter.ai.
Yeah, it's fun to play with.
So we're gonna break this probably into two podcasts.
Yeah.
My guess is, so next time we're gonna talk about couple more theories. And then finally, I want to hear what you really think happened.
Okay.
After all that, what is the answer? We need to know an answer.
I will do it. I cannot wait.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.